Is your appetite sometimes out of control? Are you unable to stop eating even when you're full? Download our new Intelligent Medicine video, Defensive Eating, Taming Your Addiction to Food. There's a physiological basis for food addiction. The food industry has gripped our brains using powerful food science. Find out what we can do about it. Go to drhoffman.com to download this important video. We will arm you with proven strategies to change your eating behavior forever. Go to drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. You can get questions to us via email, radioprogram@AOL.com, radioprogram@AOL.com. Get your questions to us, and we'll do our best to answer as many of them as we can each week when I'm joined by Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin, who is a registered dietitian and also has a master's degree in the field of nutrition and is well-versed in both mainstream orthodox nutrition as well as alternative therapies. So welcome, Layla. How are you doing?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Very good, very good. So are you weathering the Christmas run-up, the stressful time of year? And
I can't believe how fast it's coming and going by. You know, last time I blinked, I think it was August.
Yeah.
I guess that's what happens as we get older.
That's what happens. The things tend to accelerate.
And it's just not fair.
That's right. But anyway, so I think you wrote recently about ways of coping with holiday stress. So that is an article which recently appeared at drhoffman.com. You can check it out for a little bit of inspiration. And, we're besieged with temptation. There's a lot of, every time I'm out on the street, I don't have, I don't exchange Christmas gifts, Jewish, it's not a big thing, where I'm exchanging Christmas gifts, but just somehow, I'm out on the streets, I just feel this tremendous compulsion to go in and just buy something. There's like a fever,
it's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Christmas is fun.
I got to buy something, find something to buy. But
I like to avoid the stores this time of year because everybody's just crazy.
Yeah, everybody's crazy. Cool. And
shopping in January.
Right. And you think you're going to get the big bargains, but then, when the stuff is a little stale and, after the Christmas rush, a little patience goes a long way if you want to stock that cashmere sweater that you had an eye on or, whatever
exactly
you're thinking about, that pricey piece of electronics. Usually it's going to be cheaper after Christmas. Well, I want to talk briefly about an article that I wrote for the weekly newsletter. It already appeared last week, but you can check it out at drhoffman.com, which is something I'm very, very excited about, which is a real step towards personalized nutrition. I think it's actually one of the most exciting nutrition stories in the past decade because, one of our tasks when we see patients is to come up with a customized program because, for example, there's so many resources on the internet. You can go to drhoffman.com, and if you want, you can download the salad and salmon diet. You can kind of DIY, do it yourself. And then, if you're so inclined, you can download paleo diet information. You can download vegan diet, raw foods diet, blood type, a zillion diets out there. But how do you know what diet is right for you? Well, it's a matter of sort of trial and error. If you like it and it works for you, great. But it's a little bit of a shot in the dark. And so we in this field, and I know you too do this when you see patients, we're always desirous of finding ways of predicting what's the best diet for people. We can do allergy tests. We can look to see whether people perhaps are gluten sensitive, recommend a gluten-free diet. That's one of the ways. We can also look at blood tests, determine if they're insulin resistant, do a glucose tolerance test, for example, and so on and so on and so on. But a couple of Israeli scientists have really seem to have cracked the code because they came up with a very sophisticated algorithm. I think one of the reasons it's taken this long to do this is because of the limited computing power that we've had until recently. I mean, we have terrific computers, but there's so much data that they are putting together. I think there's like 167 different criteria that they pile into an analysis. You know, algorithm means a mathematical model.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you put in the patient's height, weight, you know, the medical conditions, but they even analyzed their microbiome. They did stool tests to determine if the, you know, patients had one or another type of predominant bacteria. They characterized the microbiome, and they threw this all together in, you know, in a very, very detailed computer analysis. And what they came up with was a very, very good prediction about which foods were best for patients in terms of the susceptibility to spiking blood sugar. Now, as a prelude to that, you know, you know this as well as I do, is that it's different strokes for different folks. We have this glycemic index, but there's some people who just go off the wall in response to certain foods, whereas a food that would cause another person a problem causes them barely a blip in their blood sugar.
Yeah.
So in part of their work, they ascertained that there are big differences. They found big differences in response to, say, bananas. You know, one person had a huge blood sugar surge, another person didn't, and so on with different foods. And I've actually met patients who have tested their glucose response with glucometers, handheld glucometers with a finger stick.
After a meal or something?
Yeah, they've done individual foods. It's kind of a painstaking approach. They've gone through this list of foods, you know, rice or wheat or corn.
A sweet potato.
Beets, blah, 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 you know, down the line. And I recently met one patient who says she has an absolutely off-the-wall reaction to buckwheat, which is a fairly low glycemic index food. But she just sends her blood sugar through the roof. She has demonstrated this again and again with the glucometer. So anyway, so they first they established that there are big differences. And they said, okay, well, now that we know there are big differences, what, you know, do we just throw a dart at the board and determine what people should eat? No, they applied their algorithm to a group of, I think, 100 patients, and they predicted with like 97% accuracy the degree to which they would respond to one or another food. So
97% accuracy. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Wow.
So this is, I think,
that's impressive.
This is a terrific step forward, I think, in nutritional science. And once this gets mainstreamed, and I hope it does, it may take several years, we will have tools at our disposal that will be far in advance of what we're doing now. And, you know, we kind of sit around, Layla and I, and we kind of shoot the bull between patients. And I was talking about, what if we link genetic testing to this, where we actually test people's genetic Achilles heels, strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, one person might require more vitamin D, another person more folate, another person might be more susceptible to oxidative stress, and so on and so on and so on. And then we can make...
It's so funny you mention Achilles heel, because we can also tell by genetic testing if they would be prone to Achilles injury.
It's funny that I mentioned it, but that actually, there is a gene for Achilles heel, literally. I mean, there are people, you know, some of you out there who are listening, you may have said, I had this terrible torn Achilles tendon, and it didn't seem like I was doing that much, and it just tore. Well, you know, drugs can cause that. We know that Cipro and Levaquin can predispose to Achilles heel injury, but there's actually a gene for that. And then armed with that information, we can then tell patients to go a little easy on heavy duty stress to their calves, because that's
right. Those high heels, ladies.
Yes. So I could go on and on about this. There are many articles on the internet about this. I recommend that you look at some of the ones that I reference in my story at drhoffman.com. There's an article in the Atlantic magazine about this. Very nice. And, for you nutrition aficionados out there, this is a big deal. And it made a bit of a splash in the news, but it's just tremendously exciting for me in this field to see these quantum leaps in our understanding. Good stuff.
personalized nutrition is on the horizon. It is all very exciting. It'll make bigger splashes in the news as we go forward. And, you know, the dietary guidelines will be the dinosaur that they are. Will be shown to be antiquated as they
one
are.
One size fits all is totally passé. You know, we have to account for a wide range of variations in proclivities and nutritional strengths and weaknesses. Okay, so enough said. Let's get to questions. What do we got?
Okay, our first question comes from Rachel. Rachel writes, recently I heard Russell Blaylock, neurosurgeon, say that L-glutamine is an excitotoxin, worse than sugar, and causes cancer and neurodegeneration. Many are promoting it for healing the gut and sugar cravings. I expect your opinion, Dr. Hoffman. Any evidence on this?
Yeah. This is one of these conundrum kind of things, okay?
Exactly.
Because the things that sometimes we think are good for us under certain circumstances can be potentially a trigger for cancer or other types of problems. An example of which is folate. We know that folate has... it's a methylating agent, and we know that methyl regions on DNA are gateways, control points for cancer proliferation. So if we give enough folate to someone, say, with an abnormal pap smear or with Barrett's esophagus, like a precancer, maybe we can forestall the development of that into a more advanced cancer. That being said, nature in its complexity... has also created methyl receptor sites on DNA that are cancer promoters. So there's a duality of folate. I mean, I'm answering a different question, but there's a duality to folate, and therefore in patients who...
No, it's an excellent example, because folate is a nutrient which is essential, yet... Another double-edged sword. It can feed a cancer if the cancer is already established, or at least too much of it.
Now, this is good freaks people out, because, look, frankly, I have to say that some people who are nutrition aficionados are people who are a little bit anxious. I mean, have you noticed that a little bit?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
and
they kind of hinge on orthorexia a little bit.
Yeah, they verge on orthorexia, which is like a maybe a little bit too... focused, I could use the word obsession, maybe that's a little strong, but a little focused attention.
With eating the right way all the time.
Right. And so how does this apply? I mean, clearly we don't want to be cavalier about something that could be cancer-causing. You know, this may apply only to people who have very active cancer in their bodies. Now, as to Russell Blaylock, I respect the guy. He's a tremendously brilliant guy. Yeah. But I think his views about glutamine are a little extreme. Glutamine can convert to glutamic acid. And yes, that sounds a little bit like monosodium glutamate, which has been labeled an excitotoxin, which, you know, according to his theory, it has a damaging effect on the brain and contributes to neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and so on. That, you know, you can read his book. What is it? What's the name of his book?
The Taste That Kills.
Taste That Kills.
Excitotoxin.
Right. And, you know, and I do believe it's a bad idea to take in NutraSweet and monosodium glutamate in large amounts, because that may, you know, these are exciting to the tongue, and they may actually jazz the neurons in the brain to the point where they get fried. All right.
We know that aspartame certainly does. Yeah.
Now, does glutamine do that? Well, glutamine, it's a rate limiting step. It can be converted into glutamate. It's a little bit of a leap to suggest that glutamine is going to form a neuroexcitatory toxin when taken to support the gut. But here's another interesting sidelight to that: is Thomas Seyfried, who has written about the effects of glucose in terms of promoting cancer, is also not a fan of glutamine. He believes in glutamine restriction for cancer patients. So, which is interesting, because glutamine is actually sometimes given to cancer patients because we know it helps to repair the gut during chemotherapy. It's actually a cancer drug for preventing gastrointestinal ulceration and you know, terrible diarrhea that occurs when chemo is administered because it's healing to the gut. So, you know, I think we have to kind of weigh its benefits versus its risks, and we have to keep our eye on the ball for this possibility. But I, you know, we're not entirely sold on this proposition yet.
Exactly. And, you know, glutamine can also help with sugar cravings. It's helpful in that way. It helps to boost glutathione. It can help with the muscle wasting, the cachexia associated with cancers. But I know there are some integrative physicians who kind of watch the use. They probably wouldn't advise, you know, 10 or 30 grams a day, you know, for a month of glutamine for leaky gut or anything like that.
Yeah.
They may be more cautious and maybe cap it at 5 grams a day if somebody has.
I noticed that almost all the formulas for leaky gut, for gut repair, contain glutamine. Now, that doesn't mean that these are all going to cause people, we're going to have an epidemic of cancer because people are trying to heal their gut with formulas
and
that contain glutamine.
I want to remind everyone where the glutamine is. It's an amino acid, it's a building block of protein, and it's in very, very nutritious foods like bone broths, which are also very healing to the gut. So it's a little bit of, you know, it's the way you, the analogy of folate that you described. I agree.
Yeah.
So.
Anyway.
We would watch, Rachel, but what? Thank you for that very, very thoughtful question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. We've got a question from Marlene. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, have you heard about the new kid on the block, SOD, superoxide dismutase? It's dubbed as the enzyme of life, a super antioxidant that declines with age. Well, when I hear
sounds like an advertisement.
Right, right. When I hear those who are pushing it, I wonder how long I've lived without this, or am I cutting my life short without taking some?
Well, yeah,
now there's a new formula. Yeah.
This is really interesting because the previous call was from a wonky person who's worried about glutamine. This, I think, illustrates the opposite phenomenon, which is the enthusiast. And, you know, also I think among our listenership are people who are enthusiasts. They're early adopters. You know, they want the latest, greatest thing. And a lot of these things are touted, I know because I'm in the business of nutrition, as, you know, the latest, greatest breakthrough against aging, yada, yada, yada. Superoxide dismutase, of course, is something that is present in every cell of the body. It's a little bit like glutathione. It's a natural substance that dampens down inflammation and prevents free radical damage. So superoxides are free radicals, and dismutase is something that actually helps to combat these free radicals. So SOD actually cannot be absorbed orally. It's actually broken down pretty much, and there are some schemes for providing it in some form of absorbable form that is not broken down by digestion. But the question is, it probably should be generated endogenously. In other words, inside the body. We need to enable the body to make it. So how do we do that? Well, there's three cofactors. There's copper, zinc, and I believe selenium which may play a role in superoxide dismutase metabolism. So these cofactors enable us to make our own inside the cells where it belongs. It's not that clear that taking oral SOD will actually raise levels of SOD within the cells. It is actually, it's interesting, SOD is a veterinary drug. It can be be injected. Yeah, it can be injected. I don't know if it's still available, but in the early days, when, you know, before the rules were too stringent, you know, and this sounds kind of barbaric, but really it's a natural substance. We used to use, this is many, many years ago, this is like in the early 80s when I first got started, some holistic physicians were using SOD, obtaining it from veterinary sources and giving it to people who had inflammatory problems. And I think that in theory that was a good idea, but I haven't seen a lot of research in the past couple of decades on the benefits of even intravenous SOD. Although it makes sense, you know, in people with inflammatory problems, say rheumatoid arthritis or colitis or any kind of itis or even like, or brain disorder where there's inflammation. I just haven't seen the data on SOD being that helpful, even given intravenously, which would bypass the gastrointestinal tract. So, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. So best to boost the cofactors.
Yeah.
As you say, the selenium.
I'm sorry, it's actually copper. It's not actually yep. Selenium. It's manganese. It's manganese, zinc,
oh, okay.
And copper, right? So
okay.
Selenium is the cofactor for glutathione. Sorry, temporarily got that mixed up. But
so you know where a person can naturally boost their SODs by taking something like Foundation Formula, which
yes.
has all of those.
Yes.
And in addition, take some NAC so you can also boost your glutathione naturally, and then you've got your super-duper detoxifying antioxidants.
Indeed.
Yeah, so that would be great.
Yeah.
Marlene, thank you for your question.
Was the product in question some oral form of SOD? Was that the...
Yeah.
But that's not new. That's really not new. I mean, like I say, we knew about this, you know, in the 80s.
Right.
And so, I don't know.
Hmm. Okay. Marlene, thank you for your question. Our next question is from Milena. Hi there. I know pine bark is cheaper, but aside from that, what is the difference between pine bark and pycnogenol? I've heard they're essentially the same.
Hmm.
Yes. Pycnogenol is from the French maritime pine tree.
Yeah, actually, if you ever... go to the south of France, the Riviera, you know, the Côte d'Azur, Cannes, and these regions where it's actually very windy. It's hot, windy, and arid. There's a pine tree that grows there. It's not like the pine trees that, like, you know, the pine tree we have in Rockefeller Center that's the Christmas tree. It's like a kind of a twisty, gnomish, dwarf pine tree. And one of the reasons that it's so valuable is because it grows under such harsh conditions that it has evolved some really profound antioxidant mechanisms to keep it from basically getting fried by the wind and the heat. And so that is a source of pycnogenol. Which is actually one of the better researched natural substances around. I mean, there are some newbie kinds of things that haven't been that well researched that, you know, have hit the market in, like, been around for a year. But pycnogenol has been around for a long time. And the research began in France, I think, in the 60s with a guy named Professor Masquelier. And the research is actually pretty good on it for inflammatory conditions, circulatory conditions. That's where the research is. And then I guess there are people offering a cheaper knockoff, which is pine bark, which may confer some or all of the benefits, but it's unclear. That's not the material that was used in the testing. So, I don't know. You pays your money and you takes your chances. On the other hand, maybe pycnogenol is just a brand phenomenon, and you could get a lot of the benefits just by taking ordinary pine bark. It's not clear because the research has not been done with ordinary pine bark. It's been done with pycnogenol for the most part.
Yeah. All right. Milena, thank you very much for that question.
Okay.
Okay.
There's a good point at which to pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts. So what we will do is we will pause briefly and ask our audience to follow us to part two and give us a preview, Layla, of what we're going to encounter in part two.
Okay, Synthroid versus Naturethroid.
Okay.
Will I have symptoms switching?
Okay, very good question. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with Hoffman Center Nutritionist Layla Mutin. By the way, Layla offers consultations on her own as well as jointly with me. If you want to become a patient of the Hoffman Center, you can come see me. Or alternatively, if you want to get a nutritional consult from Layla specifically, perhaps you have your own doctor or you're not inclined to travel to New York, you can consult her individually. And we share information, and we share a common vision of how clinical nutrition should be applied.
Yes.
All right. Thanks very much for joining us for this part one, and please join us for part two of today's Q&A with Layla.